prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we review underseen horror movies, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
And I'm Lance.
And we have a special guest for this episode. We have author and writer, film historian, Troy Howarth. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So for listeners, Troy is the author of multiple books, including three volumes of books on giallo films called So Deadly, So Perverse, Splintered Visions, Lucio Fulci and His Films, The Haunted World of Mario Bava, Real Depravities, the films of Klaus Kinski, Human Beasts, the films of Paul Naschy, and his latest two, which just came out last year in 2020, Assault on the System, The Nonconformist Cinema of John Carpenter, and Murder by Design, The Unsane Cinema of Dario Argento. He's also been on multiple commentaries for Blu-ray releases from many of the boutique labels that we talk about on this podcast, including the Blue Underground release of Fulci's Zombie, the Arrow Films releases of Argento's Bird with the Crystal Plumage and Fulci's Don't Torture a Duckling, Kino's release of The Psychopath, the Kino Scorpion release of Tintorera, and the Cauldron Films release of Crimes of the Black Cat, just to name a few. And so the reason that Troy is a guest for this episode, aside from those many, many credits, is because he actually did the commentary for the movie that we're going to be covering in this episode, and that is Lucio Fulci's Beatrice Cenci from 1969. And I know I said it in the last episode, I'm kind of cheating. It is not a horror movie.
Yeah.
But
it works.
It works because, number one, it is going to be Fulci's birthday this month, next week as of this episode. Also, there are definitely some elements of Fulci in this movie. And really, I think that people who are fans of Fulci, this is probably a blind spot for them. And one of the main goals of this podcast is to bring, you know, films to the forefront that we think people should see. So where you can see it, this does have a Blu-ray release by 88 Films. If you can't pick that up for whatever reason, you can watch it on YouTube, but we do recommend the 88 Films release. It is region free. And as of this recording, it has 711 views on Letterboxd.
That's crazy.
I know.
With Fulci, I mean.
Yeah. So, you know, before we get into film specifics, Troy, as far as, you know, when you talk to people about Fulci, because I know you've, you know, done a number of other podcasts talking about other Fulci movies, why do you think it is that this movie is so underseen?
Well, it didn't help that for many years it was not an easy movie to see, especially in the U.S. It didn't really get much of a play over here for a variety of reasons. It didn't have any real name value. You know, the cast is one of those casts that for a European film of its vintage was fairly distinguished. But when it came to the U.S. marketplace, it was like, who? Mm-hmm. People like Tomas Milian and Adrian LaRussa, even though Adrian LaRussa is American and Tomas Milian had come out of the actor studio. He was Cuban, but, you know, had spent a lot of time in America, but ended up in Italy. These are not actors who were known for you know, their name value in the U.S. And I think it was just it was a tough movie to see for a while. There were the only video versions that were available for a while didn't really do it any justice. They were mostly cropped versions that really helped to obscure the beauty of the cinematography, which is quite substantial. I mean, it's a beautiful looking film when you finally get a chance to see it on the 88 Films transfer. It's really, you know, an amazing thing to see. But for years, it wasn't an easy movie to see. And even though Fulci himself played it up a lot in interviews wherever he could, because it was really, it and Don't Torture a Duckling were the two films he was the proudest of. He talked about those films any opportunity he had. You know, like so many of his contemporaries, Fulci was a working kind of journeyman filmmaker who was often obliged to make films that were, you know, kind of parts of trends that were going on at a given time. Beatrice Cenci was not part of a particular trend. It was something that came together rather unexpectedly and gave him an opportunity to tell a story he was really passionate about, a story that's, of course, based in reality. But it's not the type of thing that people think of when they think of Lucio Fulci. They're thinking of zombies. They're thinking of gory horror films. And although, as you know, we've established, this isn't really a horror film, it does have horrific things in it. And certainly when you get into some of the torture scenes and so forth, that's as rough, I think, as anything you're going to see in any of his zombie movies.
You know, on that note, you sort of mentioned what type of film this was for him. Can you talk about kind of where this falls in terms of Fulci's career, what he'd been doing sort of up to this point, and where this kind of led him afterwards?
Well, he started off, as most people do, fairly low on the ladder. He was an assistant director for a long time. He, in particular, was associated with the Italian comedy specialist Steno, Stefano Benzina, who was known for making comedy films in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s. He also contributed a lot of ideas to Steno's movies, and it got to a place where he was eventually starting to get co-writing credit on a lot of his films. He wrote a lot of films through the 1950s, and as the 1950s were drawing to a close, he wanted to start directing his own films, but the opportunities that he was kind of being given at that time were to direct kind of comedy vehicles for established stars, because that was the kind of material he was known for. The Alberto Sordi film, An American in Rome, for example, was a film that he was very famous for having had a hand in writing of. And also a lot of films with the Neapolitan comic Totò, who was a huge star in Italy, whose popularity I don't think ever really translated anywhere else in the globe, but he was huge in Italy. And Fulci didn't really want to get tied down to making vehicles for comedy stars because he wanted to be kind of taken seriously as an auteur-type filmmaker. Ironically, therefore, he makes his first film. It's a movie called The Thieves, I Ladri, in 1959, which actually features Totò, but it's in a small supporting role, kind of a guest star cameo type of appearance. So it's not really a Totò vehicle, but it's an opportunity for Fulci to kind of get his career going. And then, you know, he's spending the 60s making all kinds of different films, notably comedies, but also musicals, if you can believe it. Fulci was actually also an accomplished lyricist. He had a hand in the writing of some very popular songs, you know, that were very popular at the time in the 1960s. So he was a man of many talents, very well read, very intellectual, very highly cultured. But he had a very gruff and particularly rough image, which was a fascinating contrast about him. There was a lot of kind of contradictions about him and his personality. He was, again, very well read, very cultured and intelligent man, but he didn't care about his appearance. He actually earned the nickname of Lucio Pulci, Pulci being the Italian word for fleas, because he didn't care about what he looked like. He would have coffee stains on his shirt. He used to smoke a pipe, and sometimes the pipe would be upside down and the tobacco would fall onto his sweater and he would have burn marks on his sweater, things like this. You know, a lot of people made a lot of not always very nice comments about his appearance and his hygiene, that he wasn't somebody who came across as a particularly intelligent man. But when you sat down and talked to him, he actually was very cultured. He was also extremely profane. He loved shocking people, which is no surprise when you look at his later films. He really enjoyed that sort of thing. He was really well known for his colorful language, and he didn't hold back. He liked to sort of test people. So he was kind of an interesting character. Again, a lot of contradictions and so forth. But, you know, during this period of time, through the 60s, he ended up directing a lot of films with the Sicilian comics Franco and Ciccio. That is Franco Franchi and Ciccio Ingrassia. Their popularity in Italy during the 60s and 70s was extraordinary. They made hundreds of films, spoofing every single kind of cinematic movement there was. They made spoofs of giallo films. They made spoofs of Westerns and of Pepla and all these different types of things, spy movies. I mean, you name it, they spoofed it. And Fulci wrote and directed many of their best films, and they were enormously successful. But of course, he was getting frustrated because he didn't really want to just be known as the Franco and Ciccio director, because although those films were very popular, they weren't necessarily terribly well regarded. They weren't taken seriously as kind of auteur type films. So gradually he starts to work into other different types of genres. And I think the real changing sort of turning point for him really came in the mid-60s when he made his first Western, a movie called Massacre Time, also known as The Brute and the Beast, which starred Franco Nero. And that was a film that really was the first inclination, the first sign of the kind of violence and sadism that was going to become part of Fulci cinema, really kind of his signature flourish is the sadism in his movies. That's the first one that really kind of gives a clue as to that. And then after that, you know, again, sort of bouncing around between different genres, he even directed Edward G. Robinson in a film called Operation St. Peter's, which was kind of a heist comedy. So, I mean, he was doing some fairly high-profile films here and there. He, earlier in 1969, actually at the very beginning of 1969, he directed his first giallo movie called Perversion Story, which was shot in January and February of 69, partly on location in San Francisco. And he was actually able to make use of an actual gas chamber as part of the plot for that film. But then in August of 1969, he gets to work on Beatrice Cenci, which was, you know, totally unlike anything he had made before, but was a project he was really, really super passionate about. He wrote the script in collaboration with his good friend Roberto Gianviti, who had a hand in writing quite a number of his best films. They continued collaborating off and on into the 1980s. So it was a film, you know, based on historical events that he was really keen to do. But the interesting thing about it was that right around the time that this film is getting off the ground, Dino De Laurentiis was also trying to get a version of Beatrice Cenci off the ground. I believe Christopher Plummer was supposed to be in it. It was obviously going to be a much higher profile film, a much higher budgeted film. But with that kind of extra money came extra time, and Fulci was able to kind of get his version up and running quicker. So De Laurentiis eventually canceled his version of Beatrice Cenci. So Fulci emerged triumphant in that particular situation.
And we're all better for it. I mean, not no knock on Christopher Plummer, because I do love him. But I mean, this is the version that I would want to see out of that those two, for sure.
Yeah, and you to dive into that, Troy, you had mentioned that in your commentary, that it seemed like a rushed production. It was filmed in just about 5 weeks, which is kind of amazing, you know, seeing the production and looking like a film that would, you know, take months to actually film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that the name of the game was hurry up, because Giorgio Agliani, the producer, had established a new production company to get this movie going. And I'm sure that the thought process was, if we can get this thing finished before De Laurentiis is able to get his in production, we'll end up coming ahead as the victors. And of course, that's exactly what happened. So yeah, 5 weeks is not a lavish amount of time to make a film, but for Fulci, that wasn't entirely uncommon. I mean, he did make films where he had longer periods of time, but a lot of his movies, he was obliged to kind of work quickly.
So you mentioned that this was a project that he was passionate about, but also that this is a story for Italians that is a very familiar story to them. Can you talk a little bit about the actual story behind Beatrice Cenci? And we can get into, you know, some, if we need to, some comparisons to how it actually plays out in the film. But what's the true story behind the film here?
Well, essentially, Fulci and Gianviti were pretty close to the mark on most things. They did embroider a few things. They did change a few things for dramatic effect, including one touch that Fulci, his first instance of ocular violence that became another theme later on in his films. There's a lot of people getting their eyes gouged out in Fulci movies. This is the first time that happens. That was apparently something that he threw in there, you know, just for the hell of it, because it doesn't appear to have any historical basis as far as I can tell, but it's pretty close to what happened. I mean, essentially, Beatrice Cenci was the daughter of a very notorious and kind of debauched nobleman named Count Francesco Cenci. Her mother had died earlier, but he had married again a woman named Lucrezia, and had another son with her, a little boy named Bernardo. But Beatrice and her older brother Giacomo and Bernardo and also their stepmother all kind of were tormented and abused by Francesco Cenci, who was a real bully. He abused them verbally, he abused them physically, and in Beatrice Cenci's case, certainly also sexually. He raped her on more than one occasion. he ended up being brought up on charges totally disconnected to all this. But because of his status in society, he ended up being sort of slapped on the wrist and set free. Well, not much has changed in the years since then. So certainly that aspect of it was very interesting to Fulci. He was a very left-leaning kind of a person, identified himself as a Marxist, and was very, very interested in kind of taking pot shots, both at the kind of aristocratic class, but also at the church, which there's a good bit of that in this film as well. When Cenci was due to be released, Beatrice did go to the authorities and tell them what was going on, but nobody would take her seriously. Even back then, it was not uncommon for victims of sexual assault to be doubted. And so, unfortunately, he was indeed set free. So she and her brothers and their stepmother kind of conspired to kill him off. They actually enlisted the help of two servants. One of them, a fellow by the name of Olimpio, was actually Beatrice's lover, although that was kind of kept on the down low for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. On September the 8th into the 9th of 1598, they beat him to death with a hammer. And they staged it in such a way that it looked like he fell when he was drunk. He was known to be somebody who enjoyed his wine. So they set up what they thought was a very convincing kind of fake accident. But of course, they didn't really cover their tracks very well. The papal police were brought in, and they were ultimately all subjected to torture and interrogation. Olimpio, the servant, did manage to protect Beatrice and his fellow conspirators. He died without giving anybody away, but Giacomo, the older brother, finally did crack under the torture, and he outed Beatrice as the ringleader. On the 11th of September, 1599, September 11th, again, sort of a cursed date, it would seem, they were executed publicly. Giacomo had his head smashed, and then he was quartered. By the way, poor little Bernardo was obliged to stand there and watch all of this as it happened. Then Lucrezia, his mother, was beheaded, and so was Beatrice. And then he was also to be executed, but they decided to spare him, although they ended up sentencing him to be a galley slave for the rest of his life. He was pardoned after a pretty horrific year of doing that, however. Final ironic postscript, the Cenci property and all the fortune and everything was confiscated and ultimately given to the Pope's family. So, of course, Fulci couldn't resist working that in as a postscript in his film as well.
One thing that, you mentioned the execution and it being in public. So I watched this quick little tour of Italy YouTube video that was about Beatrice Cenci. And one thing that I thought was really neat was that the painter Caravaggio was actually in the audience and saw her beheading. I thought that was really neat. So getting back to some of the production part of it, you had mentioned this sort of anti-Catholic message in this film. And also, I think in your commentary, you had mentioned that Fulci got into some hot water due to his ambivalence towards religion and that having a lot to do with some stuff going on in his personal life at the time of this film being made.
Yeah, unfortunately, Fulci had a rather difficult life in many respects. One terrible thing that happened during the making of this film, for example, was his wife Marina committed suicide. She was the mother of his daughters, Antonella and Camilla. She had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and she sent the kids off, to go to a movie or something like that. And she was home by herself, and she pretty much just put her head in the oven, and that was the end of it. Fulci came home from work that day and was greeted at the door by his mother, who gave him the news that she had committed suicide. So pretty traumatic kind of event that took place. And it certainly wasn't the first or last traumatic thing that happened in his life. He had a lot of misfortunes. I mean, he was raised as a Catholic, but he always maintained that he was a Catholic who had a lot of doubts. He said he envied Buñuel, who would describe himself, quote unquote, "I'm an atheist, thank God." Fulci said that, he never could quite embrace the concept entirely of atheism, but he had a lot of ambivalence about Catholicism in particular and its role. Basically in Italian history in a rather negative way in terms of some of the things that had happened. He was well aware of a lot of the hypocrisy and a lot of the kind of skeletons in the closet. And certainly the story of Beatrice Cenci was a perfect example of that because, again, you have this this kind of sham execution that takes place, which is, you know, effectively organized by the church and the papal police. And ultimately, they end up benefiting from it financially because they're able to seize the property and the assets of this very wealthy and very high-standing family. So, yeah, I mean, it's not exactly subtle in terms of its attitude towards the Catholic Church and, you know, and indeed towards its sort of attitude towards the general power setup and structure of Italy in general. So there was a certain amount of controversy over that. And the film wasn't terribly well received. It wasn't popular. It was regarded as a box office flop. And Fulci, like a lot of directors, he tended to kind of hold the movies that failed pretty close to his heart. It was like the children that had been rejected. So films like this, and also later giallo he made called The Psychic or Seven Notes in Black, had also been an expensive bomb, and he was very fond of that one as well. So I think it was undoubtedly a movie that he was particularly passionate about, and a film he always spoke of it with great enthusiasm, but it was tainted with this kind of memory of what had happened to his wife. And also the fact that, you know, really it did his career no favors. And there was a little bit of a gap there until he was able to finally get his next movie up and running, which was at the end of 1970. He made another giallo called A Lizard in a Woman's Skin, which was a pretty prestigious project in many respects with a very distinguished cast. So, you know, he rebounded pretty effectively. But there was a period of time there where I think life was a little bit difficult for him.
Yeah, for sure. So getting into some of the crew on the film, Fulci co-wrote this with Roberto Gianviti. They've also collaborated on Don't Torture a Duckling, 1972, A Lizard in a Woman's Skin, 1971, The Psychic, 1977, and Murder Rock, 1984. Some non-Fulci films that Roberto has worked on include Top Line with Franco Nero, which has some definite standout moments in it, including aliens and a Terminator-esque robot. It's got like a bowl that runs into the robot and it like splits them in half. It's really funny.
Nice.
I think I tried to make a GIF out of it. Anyway. Also, you watched this for Junesploitation. I think it was last year or the year before, Lance. Have a Good Funeral, My Friend Sartana Will Pay.
Yeah, I watched all the Sartana
movies. Right.
And I loved them all. That one I called The Days of Our Lives of the Sartana series. It had heavy like soap opera vibes going on. and some Confucius quotes in there.
That's great. Cinematography by Enrico Menser. He also worked on Fulci's White Fang, Argento's Cat of Nine Tails, Slap the Monster on Page One, a political satire starring Gian Maria Volonté. That one's on Cave of Forgotten Films, if anyone's interested. I just watched that last year, and it's really good. Also, The Dead Are Alive, which has the absolute most misleading title and cover. But it's also AKA The Etruscan Kills Again, which also is kind of misleading, but I do like it. But just know that if you look it up on Letterboxd, The Dead Are Alive, don't look at it and think, oh, it's a zombie movie, because it's not. Yep. The score is by Silvano Spadaccino and Angelo Francesco Lavaino. Lavaino also worked on Baba's Kill Baby Kill, Margheriti's Wild Wild Planet. And Spadaccini also worked on Fernando De Leo's Slaughter Hotel, Amar Se Mal, and Naked Violence. Lance, you usually talk about the score. Any thoughts about it?
Yeah, this one was, it's an incredibly muted score. So it's, which I think is kind of necessary because this is kind of such a dialogue-heavy, dialogue-driven script. But it's not as powerful as the performances and the subject matter, but I do think that benefits it because of it requires the actual script and the words require the full viewer's attention.
Sure.
So I think it's handled really well. I do think there is one catchy melodic tune that it's actually on the title screen, you know, the selection screen of the 88 films, which I was kind of humming to myself throughout the day. But
yeah, it is very, very catchy. And so Troy, one thing you had mentioned in your commentary, when the film first opens, there's no sound going on except for the sort of activity of the village itself or the town itself, which I think, you know, and you had pointed out, it's like, that's what Fulci wants us to focus on. And so, and I think like Lance, you mentioned, like that needs to kind of take a backseat because what we need to be paying attention to is performances, dialogue, and the events that are actually occurring.
Yeah, I had talked about that too, briefly on A Bay of Blood, where mm-hmm. Stelvio Cipriani would just cut off all music during the kill scene. So you're just left hearing, like Brunhilde, who when she was killed in Bay of Blood, the birds chirping, you know, it's it allows you to really focus in on what's happening on screen.
Yeah. And so I mentioned before, something we don't always bring up on this podcast because it doesn't usually play in, but the costume design.
It's a period piece.
The period piece. So we should talk about it. Costumes by Mario Giorsi. He's done a good number of sword and sandal films, including Bava's Hercules and the Haunted World, Nightmare Castle with Barbara Steele, Margheriti's Seven Deaths in the Cat's Eye, which I watched a couple years ago for June's exploitation, and honestly, the only thing I remember is an adorable fat orange kitty. I mean, I know it's a good movie, but I also that I just get distracted. That's, when a cat is central to a movie, I get distracted.
That's good enough reason to watch it.
He's also worked on post-apocalypse movies, including Fulci's New Gladiators and Enzo Castellari's The New Barbarians, as well as a Western starring Klaus Kinski called And God Said to Cain.
Well, that's a good one.
Yeah, I have that on my list. I haven't watched it yet. That was going to be a pick for me to watch this month. I ended up choosing something else, but I'm still going to watch it as a backup because a lot of people have recommended that one. So I ended up watching another Klaus Kinski movie the other day called Golden Knight, which was really interesting and has a marionette, a carved marionette of Klaus Kinski, like traipsing around and like Klaus Kinski's putting on a puppet show of himself and like other people. And it's like the greatest thing ever. Now I want nothing more in the world than a Klaus Kinski marionette.
That's as good as a fat orange cat. Like I need to watch that.
I want both things. I want all the things. Okay, so a couple of things about production I wanted to just kind of touch on that you brought up in your commentary, Troy, is the location, because I think location-wise that I think a lot of our viewers might appreciate that the castle scene in Bill and Ted's Adventure is at the same location of this mm-hmm. as this movie, which I thought was really neat.
Yeah,
that's the Castello Odescalchi, I believe is pronounced, in Bracciano. Yeah, a familiar location. All the interior work is done at De Paola Studios, which is where Fulci shot a lot of his films, really most of his best. But a lot of, I mean, in general, you know, Argento shot there and various other filmmakers. So if you're a genre fan, De Paola is as important as Cinecittà.
So regarding, you had mentioned a previous adaptation by Ricardo Freda, by Ricardo Freda from 1956. Did that one do really well in Italy? And do you know anything as far as like, did Fulci compare the success of that one to his own?
I mean, Freda was definitely a director that Fulci respected. Fulci was not somebody who dispensed praise easily. He didn't tend to say things to flatter people. If he didn't like a particular director, he had no problem saying so, but he did like Freda. He always referred to Mario Bava as the great Mario Bava. Of course, they were friends. They had worked together on a couple of films when Fulci was an assistant and Bava was a cameraman, like the Sins of Casanova, mm-hmm. Which was directed by Steno in the mid-50s. Bava actually worked on Beatrice Cenci in a uncredited capacity, the Freda version, that is, you know, doing some of the cinematography and some of the mat work, I believe. I don't know how it did financially. I think it did well enough. I mean, Freda had a lot of success going back into the 1940s, making sort of swashbuckler costume type films. And that was the kind of movie that he really wanted to make. But of course, later he became identified with horror films and thrillers, which were not the types of films he really wanted to do. So he always had kind of an ambivalent attitude about it. His version of Beatrice Cenci is far less passionate. It's much more, it unfolds like a series of tableaux. It's very painterly. It's very well composed. It's really a beautiful looking film. But it doesn't have the kind of fire and intensity that Fulci brings to his version. And it doesn't have the heat, literal heat, that Fulci brings to his film. I mean, Fulci's Beatrice Cenci, I think one of the very few period pieces that successfully deals with the whole concept of how uncomfortable it must have been to have worn those kinds of clothes.
Everybody is so sweaty.
So dripping.
And plucking at their costume. You see sweat dripping off of noses and everything else. That's rare. You don't see that in many period pieces. Usually everything's really pretty. So Freda's version, of course, is very pretty.
Yeah.
But But there have been versions going all the way back to the silent era. There have been a version in 1909 by Mario Casarini. There was another one in 1911 by Ugo Falena. And there was a version in the 1940s. So it was a story that kept coming back. And, of course, it had also been adapted in various other ways as well. Percy Shelley had written a verse about Beatrice Cenci. There had been an opera. There was various different sort of theater adaptations, including one by Antonin Artaud called Les Cenci from 1935. And Artaud, of course, the creator of the so-called theater of cruelty, was a big influence on Fulci as well. So I'm sure that he was thinking along the lines of the Artaud play as well whenever he and Gene Vitti were doing their script. So, and Alberto Moravia had done a play back in 1958. So, you know, again, for the Italian sort of popular consciousness, this is a very, very well-known story that cropped up with a great deal of regularity.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of something on, you know, on our side of the pond that has that same sort of story ingrained into, I mean, I guess maybe something like Salem Witch Trials maybe would be a point of comparison. Just, you know, if we're talking I don't want to say wrongfully accused, because Beatrice did it, but I mean,
she had good reasons.
She did.
It's kind of complicated.
Yeah. Wrongfully convicted, not wrongfully accused, I guess.
Right.
So getting into the cast of this film, we've got, I guess, probably the most notable actor in this would be Tomas Milian, who plays Olympio. He's got 100 plus film credits. Obviously, we're not going to go through all of them. I just want to bring up a few of note. He also worked with Fulci in Don't Torture a Duckling and for The Apocalypse. And he's most well known for just his prolific acting in Eurocrime and spaghetti westerns, including Almost Human, The Tough Ones, Face to Face, just to name a couple. And then Adrian LaRussa as Beatrice Cenci. She was also in The Man Who Fell to Earth, Psych Out for a Murder, and Lance, for you, she was in the TV soap opera Days of Our Lives.
Yes.
So one thing that you also mentioned in your commentary, Troy, is about LaRussa and Fulci not getting along, and most specifically because of the nudity aspect, where she said in her contract she would not get naked. However, she gets naked in The Man Who Fell to Earth. So do you think it's because she took issue with Fulci or maybe like she was just at a different point in her career and she realized, well, I guess I need to do it for this? I'm not sure.
I think by the time she's doing something like The Man Who Fell to Earth, you know, Nicholas Rogue is quite well established and quite well regarded. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of a prestigious film by comparison. And I think it's one of those things where if a big director asks you to do something you wouldn't normally do, you're going to do it.
Sure.
I think the best example that I can come to mind with is my favorite actor, Christopher Lee, who only once in his career removed his hairpiece, and that was for Billy Wilder in The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. Mm. And the only reason he did that was because Wilder wanted him to go without, because the character of Mycroft Holmes was supposed to be bald pated, which Lee was, but he always wore a hairpiece to cover that up. So I think that's kind of the case, you know, when she did that film. It's like, well, okay, you know, I'll do it for Rogue, but she wasn't going to do it for Fulci. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those situations where it's not as if she signed on to the film not knowing what the sequence was going to be. It was obviously a very integral part of the plot, and it's not gratuitous. So, you know, obviously it caused a certain amount of bad blood, and he had a kind of perverse way of getting back at her because of that.
Yeah.
Well, also, and for LaRussa, I mean, if I was in a film with David Bowie, I would probably take all my clothes off.
Yeah, but she doesn't get naked with David Bowie.
I know.
She gets naked with Rip Torn, which, I mean, young Rip Torn, I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying, like, you know.
Right. And then, like, for our listeners, there are nude scenes in Beatrice Cenci, but it's a body, yes. It's a body double.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And she's, I think Adrian LaRussa had issue with the body double. I think she politely called her a big girl compared
well,
to
I think
herself.
That was the thing that Fulci said, okay, if you're not willing to do it, then we'll get you a double. And he went out of his way to find somebody who was not terribly attractive.
Yeah.
So, but it's very fleetingly glimpsed in the film. Mm-hmm. It's actually very discreet. So, you know, you wouldn't be any the wiser, but no,
yeah,
he did not like her. Fulci has a reputation for being a misogynist. I don't think it's quite entirely accurate. I think he's more of an out-and-out misanthrope, but certainly he did have complicated relationships with not just actresses, a number of actors in his films, but it all depended on how they responded to him. I think he really liked to challenge people, and if they stood up to him and they could give it back as good as he gave it, they earned his respect. And I think also he had a lot of respect for actors who were real actors. You know, if somebody was really serious about what they were doing and they were bringing their A game to it, he absolutely loved them. But on a lot of these films, because of the way Italian films were done, it wasn't unusual to get people who were amateurs off the street, or maybe the latest girlfriend of the producer was put into a role and they weren't very good, and maybe they had a little bit of a diva attitude or something like that. So he could definitely be very volatile.
Well, he did seem to like Milan and Wilson, is at least as far as like what he's gone on record as saying. So,
oh, yeah.
So the role of Francesco Cenci was played by George Wilson. He's also another Francesco in Fulci's Don't Torture a Duckling, as well as, is he the king or the, in Borowczyk's Blanche? No, yeah, he is the king who comes to visit and is courting the wife of the lord of the home. And great performance in that as well. This is how bad my memory is, Lance. I just watched this movie like 2 weeks ago and I already forgot which one he is.
You watch a lot of movies.
I watch too many because that's why I forget everything. So
he showed up in the Richard Lester Three Musketeers as well. Oliver Reed and, you know, Christopher Lee was in that too, and Michael York and so forth. So, yeah, he had done a lot of pretty high-profile films. And as you say, Fulci was definitely a big fan of his, and also Tomas Milian, who, you know, he was a huge star in Italy throughout the 1970s. You mentioned because of his spaghetti westerns, but also the Poliziotteschi. He was immensely popular for those films. But the three films that he did with Fulci were you know, certainly among the three best films that he ever made. So I think he regarded him as kind of a good luck charm.
Yeah. Let's see. A few others. We've got Lucrezia Petroni, the stepmother. She's played by Marie Bardenzillo. Beatrice's brother, Don Giacomo, is played by Antonio Casagrande. He's also in Umberto Lenzi's Gang War in Milan. He's Lino, one of the main characters in that. And then Catalano is played by Ignacio Spalla. He's in a lot of spaghetti westerns, including three Sabata movies. And he's also the bar owner in Hitchhike with Franco Nero and David Hess.
Mm.
I like Catalano. Like his whole...
Yeah, he was like the very minimal, very little humor that's in this movie was pretty much provided by him.
Yeah, I like him for that. Anything you wanted to add regarding the cast, Troy?
Well, I mean, again, you know, Adrian LaRusso and Fulci, obviously that was not a match made in heaven, but she does give, I think, a very good performance in the film, which ultimately is the most important thing. I think, you know, it's interesting that in this version, Fulci puts a good deal of emphasis on the character of Olimpio, the Tomas Milian character, who ultimately comes off as a very tragic character, whereas Beatrice is depicted in a way that's difficult to decipher at times. There's a kind of deliberate flatness to her reactions to certain things that keeps her very ambiguous and very ambivalent, which is an interesting dramatic device because it makes it a little unclear at times whether she's being manipulative or whether she's just being brave. And it kind of depends on how you look at it. But I think the entire cast does a really, really fine job. And I would add also Raymond Pellegrin as the Cardinal, who is very, very effective in the film. He had also played a very significant role for Jean-Pierre Melville in Le Deuxième Souffle with Lino Ventura, one of the great sort of French noir films. He'd done that just a couple years before this. So he was a great asset to the cast as well. Everybody's just very well cast in this, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as far as, you know, getting into the actual sort of points of discussion in this, one of the main things to point out is really the really strong performances in this. And, you know, you had mentioned LaRusso's already, and as far as how she plays this sort of, she's cold and deliberate, but she doesn't have to, she's not attention seeking for the sympathy, but it's like what has happened to her, that's enough for us to be on her side.
Yeah, it's the silent determination that she kind of presents. Like, you can see pain and annoyance in certain scenes, yeah. Like when Olivia won't go through with, you know, the killing, the stabbing. She just has this determined demeanor that I'm on her side. I mean, as a title character, I'm just, yeah. But what Troy points out too, it's at times she is very cold looking, like, is this all for, you know, the end game of what she wants to do with her father.
Yeah. But not to be like outdone, I think one thing that I really like in this too is because most of the films that I've seen Tomas Milian in are spaghetti westerns, yeah. Eurocrime movies, like where he is just scuzzy. And in this one, he's almost this like lovesick puppy.
Yeah, it's very subtle, very shy. And one of my favorite roles is him as Vasco in Sergio Corbucci's Companeros from 1970. I love that film with Franco Nero stars okay. in it. Yeah, he's usually really on, like, you know, going crazy, or he's playing Olympia.
Yeah, he, again, he came from a background, you know, theater trained. He had worked at the Actor's Studio. He was a very serious actor, very methody in many respects, which is something that I could see where that would irritate somebody like Fulci, but they actually got along very well because he took what he was doing very seriously. You know, he had a tendency later on, I think some of this is down to his, you know, admitted drug use during that time. There was a fair amount of cocaine going around with Tomas Milian back in those days. After a certain point, he started rewriting a lot of his lines in his films and coming up with these really over the top, you know, incredibly profane speeches that he would give, like in a lot of Umberto Lenzi's Poliziotteschi and things like that, you know, where he was playing characters that were very disenfranchised and but also incredibly scuzzy. You know, he became known for playing characters like Monezza or the hunchback character that he played, you know, in some of the films. He was really into kind of the exterior stuff, wigs, makeup, costumes, things that he could hold on to help, you know, sort of anchor a performance. He always said he liked to find the right hat, for example. And so, you know, in Companeros, for example, he wears this sort of beret,
yeah.
You know, and he would always find ways of using these props and things. But in the first two Fulci films that he did, this one and Don't Torture a Duckling, he's really very restrained and mm-hmm. quite normal. He's also Andrea, the reporter in Don't Torture a Duckling, and that's right. a very subtle, low-key performance as well. The most Milian-esque performance that he gave for Fulci was in the last one, For the Apocalypse, where he plays a sort of Charles Manson-esque psychopath called Chaco.
Mm-hmm.
That's more what you would expect out of Tomas Milian, whereas the first two performances are really, again, quite, they don't rely on wigs, they don't rely on makeup, they don't rely on anything terribly extravagant, but he still holds your attention.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think he's great in this. So one of the other things that I, you know, you brought up in your write-up in your book, in the Splintered Visions, is regarding the way the narrative actually plays out. So when I first watched this, the flashbacks within flashbacks, the fact that it's not told in a linear fashion kind of threw me off at first. And it took a while for me to acclimate myself to the way the story was being told. And then on the second time I watched it, knowing that going in, I enjoyed it that much more. But can you kind of speak to why you think the story wasn't told as a linear story versus, you know, essentially three different timelines or flashbacks within flashbacks?
I think it had a lot to do with the fact that Fulci knew how well known the story was by that point. So an interesting way of approaching it would be to kind of get different perspectives, you know, different people telling their version and their account of things, kind of almost Rashomon in that sense,
mm-hmm.
of, you know, going back over a particular incident and offering various different perspectives. I mean, Mario Bava had made a film in 69, although it didn't come out until 72, called Four Times at Night, which was a sex comedy very much informed by Rashomon, where it's a date gone wrong that's told from four different perspectives. And, of course, everybody has a very different accounting. So, Fulci being well aware of the fact that the Italian public is going to know this story and is going to be, you know, painfully aware of every turn. I mean, there's really no twist he can work in here that's going to surprise people. Mm-hmm. I think that he and Gene Vitti very sensibly realized, you know, it'd be more interesting if we did this in a more kind of a jigsaw type pattern or style where, it, you know, we take them so far, then we break and we go back and we start from over here. And it kind of keeps things fresh and keeps things interesting as opposed to getting bogged down in something that, again, you know, probably the average school child would have known.
Right.
Yeah, and Erica, when you picked this movie, you gave me a heads up of the narrative structure.
Yeah.
So I knew it going in, but still, I think this movie, like you pointed out, gets much better with multiple viewings, because I did rewatch it, and knowing the history and the story of the Cenci story, I just appreciated that much more. I was able to focus really in on not only all his directing and stuff, but the separation and how the story comes together, you know, including all the almost like the investigative work of the church and stuff. Like it almost becomes like a little poliziotteschi, like in that regard. I don't know.
Yeah, you have the inspector, the Umberto Dorsey character, who's another fun character in the film. He's perpetually battling a cold,
yeah.
So he's always sniffling and, you know, rubbing at his nose and so forth. You know, again, with all the sweat and everything else going on, just adds to the kind of ickiness of the film, very tactile kind of quality that it has. But yeah, I mean, it's this whole idea of kind of trying to get to the bottom of the truth, and also, you know, acknowledging the fact that, you know, in historical records and reporting and so forth, there's always the possibility that things have been misreported or have been unfairly skewed, you know, to make certain people look more guilty than others. So it's that kind of examination of, you know, the nature of truth as well.
I feel like at this point, you know, if listeners are not yet on board with why they should watch this movie, I'm going to give you some more reasons now and why this still feels like a Fulci movie. So I've got 3 points for that. I've got gore, sweat, and beard vomit in it on my notes. So
yes, indeed.
So we already kind of talked about the sweat. Like, it's, you know, the opening of it, you see just people are just drenched. They're pulling at their clothes. They're uncomfortable. So you can feel that aspect of it. The beard vomit comes up in the cave, and it's just this, like, this guy just pukes on himself and his vomit gets in his beard. And I've seen that at the bars on Sixth Street where people are just foul. And so and I love that little touch where it's not like, you know, I haven't seen the Fredo version, but I would imagine obviously something like that would never make its way into Freda's version of Cenci. And
no.
So I love those little touches like that, because then it almost feels like a warm blanket. Like if all you've watched of Fulci is the zombie or the Gates of Hell trilogy and New York Ripper and going, you've got those elements that will still give you the Fulci blanket and make you feel at home in it. And besides that, we have multiple instances of gore in it. So, and there's also one absence of gore, which I want to get to, in the execution itself. But let's start with the dog mauling at the beginning. And, you know, we had mentioned the eye trauma, which comes up multiple times in Fulci movies in the future, but also the dog mauling. Again, we get that later in The Beyond. So, and then the torture sequences themselves, especially when Olympio is being tortured. And
when he's
like
getting branded on the nipples.
Oh, it's being branded. Oh my God, you can feel it going into his skin because it's so close to it. Plus all the sweat is there. This is a Fulci film, guys. You should be watching this movie. I don't care if it's a period drama.
Yeah, the dog mauling in The Beyond, of course, everybody's go-to with that is they say, well, of course, he was copying Dario Argento from Suspiria. And yeah, of course, Suspiria was a huge hit. It was an immense, it was one of the top grossing movies in Italy. The Earth came out in 1977, and it sold well internationally. It did really well in the U.S., and it's a huge, huge hit. But Fulci was already doing things like that before. I think, actually, it serves in this context. It calls back to Massacre Time, which I mentioned before, which has a sequence towards the beginning of the film where the kind of upper-crust sadistic villain, played by Nino Castelnuovo, sets dogs loose on this man who has displeased him. And I think he does the same thing in both films. It's been a while since I've watched both of them, but I think in both films there is this wonderful little sort of shock cut whenever somebody's getting mauled, to a kind of close-up of somebody biting down on their lip.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As they're watching it happen. It's just something that just adds this little sort of punctuation point to it, which is partway kind of shock and partway almost this kind of sadistic, sexualized pleasure that the sadist is getting out of what's happening. So, yeah, that's definitely very much in evidence in this film.
The murder of Francesco itself. So in the real story, like Troy mentioned, he's beaten to death with a hammer and then made to look like he fell. As much as I appreciate the way that, you know, this was written and played out in the film, and I don't know if it was purposeful to make the audience frustrated with them, but if the intent is to say, we're going to throw him off a building so it looks like, you know, he had an accident, what they did to him doesn't really help with that.
Yes. Well, one of the things that got them whenever, you know, the police investigated in real life was that they didn't cover up their tracks very well. Mm. And they didn't count on the fact that when they were bludgeoning this man to death, that there was, you know, there was blood being splattered on the walls, which they never cleaned up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is obviously well before the days of DNA and things like that. But, you know, it was pretty obvious, and there were various other clues that they left behind. So mm-hmm. I think for Fulci, it was just this opportunity to kind of really up the ante as far as the violence was concerned and do something that really would possibly shock people, because that's not something that was based on historical reality. You know, the gouging of the eye, that was just kind of his little extra flourish there. Yeah. Free of charge. And it's something that, again, it recurs over and over and over again. But it's, you know, it's not just Fulci. I mean, interestingly, the first really major Italian horror film was Bava's Black Sunday from 1960. And that included a scene that was cut for many years where a vampire's eye is pierced with a spike. Mm-hmm. So there seemed to be this interest in kind of gouging out the eyes and so forth. And Fulci always said that you have to... the eyes have to be the first thing to go because they've seen too many terrible things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to knock on the Fulci flourish. I do love it. That actually, the first time I watched it, really took me aback. And that's from someone who's seen tons of Fulci films multiple times. So I can imagine the reaction that an audience in 1969 would have had to something like that in a period drama about a story that they were very familiar with. Like, they knew the murder was coming. But then to get this, like, eye-gouging trauma.
Yeah, nailed to the eye, a nail to the throat. And that scene is violent and pretty graphic. Yeah. Because Francesco's, you know, just squirming and gurgling while he bleeds out for mm-hmm. quite a while. And then in the room is a bird just freaking out, adding to the chaos. So yeah.
Yes, that's a nice touch.
Yeah, it's not nearly as graphic as his later films, but, I mean, it's just as effective as any murder scene.
Yeah.
Well, I think it reminds me a little bit of... there's a not very good Hitchcock film from a couple years before called Torn Curtain, which has one really celebrated sequence in it where Paul Newman and this farm woman, have to kill a East German agent who is tracked down Newman and is trying to, trying to out him as a spy, where Hitchcock said, you know, I'm tired of seeing scenes in movies where people just get stabbed once and they fall over, or they get shot and they fall over and that's it. He wanted to show how difficult it was to really kill somebody. So there's this incredibly protracted, nasty death sequence in the film, which, in an irony of sorts, you know, given what I said before about what happened with Fulci's wife, it actually ends with his head being put in the oven, which had a significant meaning in that time too, in the sense of the whole Holocaust thing and everything else, you know, this East German spy. So that sequence was really one of the first attempts to kind of show the grim reality of what it's really like to kill somebody. And I think Fulci wanted to do something very similar with this, and I think it works really well.
Lance, do you have anything else in your notes that you wanted to bring up? I kind of went through all mine.
No, I just wanted to point out Fulci's, and I know this isn't, you know, he'd been making films for decades, but his direction is just incredibly strong in this, because it is a dialogue-driven, very dialogue-heavy film. So to make those conversations interesting, you know, Fulci provides us these dynamic stagings of the actors and great angle shots. There's a great scene of Francesco and the Cardinal walking around speaking in front of a huge piece of meat that's being cooked over the fire.
Yeah.
And Fulci then gives us a shot like from inside the fireplace, you know, with the flames kind of licking the bottom underneath. It's just gorgeous camera work and framing. And then he does really effective, nice zooms throughout. There's, you know, the one scene where Olympio and Beatrice are in bed together. The camera kind of zooms out of the room to show that they're truly alone and kind of conspiring.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he loves, you pointed this out too in your commentary, Troy, but that diopter lens, the fantastic split diopter lens. Yeah, it's just really gorgeous to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Everybody always kind of, I don't know, they kind of go bend over backwards to talk about the idea that Brian De Palma is sort of ripping off Argento in certain films. And I don't really think it's true, because De Palma was asked about this point blank, and he said, you know, look, back in the 70s, Scorsese showed me a couple of Argento and Bava films, but I didn't really pay much attention to them. I wasn't interested in them. So I don't think he was really kind of consciously trying to crib anything from Argento. Maybe something kind of slipped into the back of his brain, but I don't think that was something he was really deliberately trying to do. What people don't talk about is how Fulci, in many respects, anticipates a lot of the things that De Palma did later on. I'm certainly not suggesting De Palma took anything from him, because I doubt that he even knows who he is. But a lot of the things he did with split diopter and with split screen as well, there's a lot of split screen work in Perversion Story and in Lizard in a Woman's Skin. It's a fantastic sequence at the beginning of Lizard in a Woman's Skin, where he's contrasting the sort of hedonistic atmosphere of the neighbor's apartment, where they're having a drug-fueled orgy, versus a very staid and stuffy apartment with the protagonist and her family, you know, and it sort of stiff upper lip English family versus this hedonistic thing going on next door. And there's some split screen stuff going on. It's really, really great. I don't think that a lot of people realize what a really inventive and absolutely, you know, totally in control of technique filmmaker he really was. I think largely because the first 20 years of his career, most people don't really pay as much attention to as they should. They really kind of seem to want to start with Zombie and then move on from there. But that's one of the reasons I'm so glad that you're doing something about this film in particular, because this is a very significant film, 10 years into his career as a director, one of his very best, and yet that entire period of his career, in many respects, with the exception of a couple of the Jalli, which have kind of crept through and grabbed people's interest, A lot of these movies really aren't being noticed or talked about. And it's a great shame, because they really, I think, show him at the top of his game, not just in terms of his technique, but also in terms of the money that he had to work with. So he had the best collaborators, the best cameramen during this period, and he's doing really, really cutting edge work.
Absolutely. Did you have anything else besides what we've already discussed that you wanted to bring up about the film, Troy?
No, I mean, just, you know, to sort of piggyback on what you were saying before about, you know, I hope that more people will start to go outside of the comfort zone and check out other things that he did. You know, you talked about the warm blanket aspect. I mean, he made a Poliziotesco in between his first two horror films, between Zombie and City of the Living Dead. He made a movie called Contraband, which unfortunately is only readily available in a really lousy English dub. Most of the films that he did, the English dubs are perfectly fine, but Contraband sounds awful in English, so I'm hoping somebody can put it out in Italian. But it is such a grim, vicious, and violent movie that I think even for fans of that particular genre, it might be a little too much. You know, he didn't shy away from those things, and I think that was one of the things that really made him stand apart from the rest. It was his technical skill, his ability to tell a story, which, again, because a lot of the later horror films are deliberately light on story, There is this tendency to think that he didn't know how to tell a story. Well, that's absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. Something like Beatrice Cenci or Don't Torture a Duckling, you know, shows how inaccurate that is. But it was also his fearlessness when it came to certain things. Like, he would not cut away when most people would. Mm-hmm. So that kind of spirit lives on, and I think makes his films continue to be incredibly popular long after he's died.
Long live Fulci. Everyone celebrate his birthday by watching this movie, please. So let's get to double feature recommendations. So Troy, we normally will, you know, just say, what's a movie that would go well with this? Complement it side by side, maybe has... it could just be, sometimes we just go straight like director double feature, but sometimes we do more thematic ones. So do you have any thoughts about a double feature to go with Beatrice Cenci?
Well, I suppose if you wanted to pair it up with another Fulci film of, you know, kind of similar subject matter in terms of its sort of anti or at least ambivalent Catholic attitude, you could go with Don't Torture a Duckling. But in terms of sort of historical fact-based genre film that deals with the whole concept of torture and you know, just abuse of justice, I think Michael Reeves' film, Witchfinder General, would make a good, if very depressing, double bill with this.
Oh, we're fine with depressing. Like, I mean, you should hear our episode on Never Take Candy from Strangers. Like, I went for like a full Stranger Danger molestation double feature, so we don't shy away. Oh, that's a great pick. I love both of those. I'd be happy with a double of either of those. Lance, what about you? Double feature.
This one was a tough one for me. You know, should I go with another period piece? Should I pick another Fulci? But I went back and forth on a few, and I decided on Ms. 45, also known as Angel of Vengeance.
Huh.
Directed by Abel Ferrara.
Yeah.
Released in 1981, starring Zoe Lund as Thana, who is Ms. 45. This is one of my favorite exploitation films. Incredibly grimy, sleazy, just uncomfortable. But it follows a woman who's raped multiple times throughout the course of a day, and she essentially gets revenge in her own way. It has a complicated feminist message, which I think Beatrice Cenci does as well, but... Spoiler alert, although there is revenge against abusive men, the lead character does not live past the credits, just like Beatrice. So, although completely different films, I think following up Beatrice Cenci with Ms. 45 would make a satisfying revenge double feature.
Okay. Can get down with that. So I am going with a patricide double feature.
Okay.
And I have a TV movie from 1975 starring I Dream of Jeannie's Elizabeth Montgomery. It's The Legend of Lizzie Borden. So I've seen a few versions of the telling of this story. So kind of like Beatrice Cenci, which has multiple tellings of this story. I've been to the Lizzie Borden house, too. I got to lay on the couch and everything.
Oh, wow.
It was a great experience. But I do think this is actually my favorite version of this telling, because I think I've told you before, I watched the one with Chloe Sevigny and Kristen Stewart, and I couldn't deal with Kristen Stewart's 12-year-old boy body in that, because they get naked in it. And Elizabeth Montgomery gets naked in this, and I'm not body shaming, I'm sorry, I don't want it to come off like that.
But, no, I mean, you're just...
But I don't want to see a 12-year-old boy body.
You're Kristen Stewart shaming.
Yeah, I'm Kristen Stewart shaming, it's different, okay. Anyway, I think these work together not just because of the patricide, but also because of the performances by the female leads. So LaRussa and Montgomery, they have this sort of matched energy of being cold and calculating without needing to make the audience sympathetic. So The Legend of Lizzie Borden is on YouTube. The quality is awful, though. So just FYI for folks. But this seems like something like Kino might pick up someday, because they tend to do a lot of TV movies, I think.
Yeah.
But if you get a chance, I recommend, if you want to watch a good version of The Legend of Lizzie Borden, this is probably my favorite. Okay, so that is it for Beatrice Cenci. Again, happy birthday, Lucio Fulci, next
June
week.
17th.
June 17th, yes. Please celebrate it by watching one of his films, preferably this one. But we have another episode to get to this month. And Lance, it's your pick. What are we doing next episode?
We are going to be covering The Passing from 1984, written, directed by, and starring John Huckert. This is more a psychological sci-fi horror than a straight-up horror film. Definitely has horror elements, though. It follows two elderly World War II veterans who are both living together and declining in health. One of them enrolls in an experimental procedure to have his consciousness transplanted into a younger man's body.
Oh, shit. I've seen this.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt. Sorry. I was like, I've never heard of this movie while you're talking about it.
I think I saw you did see this
okay,
already.
Sorry. Go ahead.
The younger man, being a convict on death row, he must also agree to this procedure. There's a lot of weird character reflections and odd scenes throughout the film, leaving a lot to unpack. So I'm looking forward to discussing this one with you, Erica.
Okay.
The Passing currently has 360 views on Letterboxd. It's currently streaming on Tubi. And Vinegar Syndrome have a Blu-ray release with some great commentaries and extra features. I did check the Tubi version, and it is the newly scanned and restored 2K Vinegar Syndrome version, which is nice. So, yeah, add some additional views to Letterboxd and listen to us talk about The Passing.
All right, looking forward to it. And if you are not already, you can give us a follow on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Slasher, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd under the username also watched. And Lance, where can people find and follow you?
I'm on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at lshivey.
Troy, do you have anything upcoming that you want to that you can mention? I know sometimes with commentaries you got to keep it under wraps until it gets announced, but anything coming up that you want to plug?
Severin just put out the Euro Crypt of Christopher Lee box set. I did two commentaries for that one along with Nathaniel Thompson. We covered Castle of the Living Dead, which in addition to featuring Lee also has Donald Sutherland in his film debut. And a really atmospheric movie with a terrible title that's been stuck on it down through the years called The Torture Chamber of Dr. Sadism. The title, it makes you expect something much more graphic than it really is. So, you know, so kind of temper your expectations. It's more like a fairy tale than anything else. But really good film, though. We did just recently record a commentary for a film I'm very excited to talk about, but I can't talk about it just yet. So hopefully the news will be announced within the next month or two. We have more lined up, of course, commentary-wise. In terms of books, you went through all the ones before. Right now, I am working on a book on the films of Umberto Lenzi.
Ooh.
And that is tentatively titled Make Them Die Slowly, The Kinetic Cinema of Umberto Lenzi. Much more ignored and kind of neglected filmmaker than Fulci and his ilk, although their careers kind of cross-sected in many respects, and indeed they were good friends as well. So he's another person who had a kind of interesting, eclectic filmography that most people have ignored, like, you know, 75% of what he's done in favor of a few popular movies. So, yeah, I'm working on that now. And I also did a book on Alice, Sweet Alice, the American film that's very much like a giallo, by Alfred Sohl. Unholy Communion, Alice, Sweet Alice from Script to Screen, which includes the complete original script donated by Alfred Sohl for this project, and all kinds of behind-the-scenes anecdotes, and a very lengthy interview that I did with Alfred Sohl last year or the year before? I can't even remember. But anyway, it's coming out sometime this year from Bear Manor.
Awesome.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to all of that. I like the titles for those, too. Like, Lance and I have actually joked about doing another podcast about just Jolly and calling it Bring in the Perverts.
Bring in the Perverts. Oh, yes. It's one of my favorite bits.
Okay, so we're also going to be posting links to where you can buy all of Troy's books in our show notes. I'm definitely looking forward to the Eurocrypt. I pre-ordered that. I've been waiting fucking months for that thing. And so hearing that you've got some commentaries on it, I'm even more excited for it to finally get to my house. So thank you so much, Troy, for all of your insights on this film and for championing some of our favorite directors and films that a lot of them we can't cover on the podcast because they don't fit our criteria. But, you know, your commentaries are great. Your books are really insightful. And it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, well, it's been a real treat.
Thank you.
So thanks to Troy once again. And thanks to everyone for listening. And we'll see you back next episode for The Passing.
Night, y'all.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.